Hello and welcome to this PSG Think Big series podcast. In this program, Alicia Seckham speaks to the judges of the PSG Think Big competition, discussing the competition topic of the role of capital markets in South Africa, with a focus on new solutions for embracing economic growth and job creation.
Hello and welcome to the Think Big series brought to you by PSG. I'm Alicia Seckham, and for this episode, we're going to be doing things a little differently. We're going to be tapping into a conversation that I had with this year's Think Big competition judges on the back of PSG having recently announced this year's winners. The topic at hand, the role of capital markets in enhancing economic growth and job creation as well in South Africa. It was a topic that triggered quite a bit of engagement with over 200 entries received and the demographic wide ranging. I sat down with Francois Gous, who's of course CEO of PSG Financial Services, Malungelo Zilimbola, who's CEO of Mazi Asset Management, Fatima Vauda, CEO of 27Four Group, Chris Luvalt, who's head of economic research at the South African Reserve Bank, and of course, an MPC member as well, and Leila Fourie, who's CEO of the JSC, and started off by asking Francois for some context to the reality in South Africa right now and to engage with the topic around economic growth, because we certainly have economic growth being preached. The question, is it being practiced?
Thanks, Alicia. First of all, just to say we're very excited about all the contributors. It was a generally positive response that we've had, and I think the participants in doing the papers gave optimistic views about South Africa. But I think to your question directly, I think you have to baseline where we are. And the economic circumstances in South Africa is very difficult. We've got the highest debt to GDP since 94. We've got the highest deficits that we've had since 94. We've got the weakest credit rating that we've had since 94. We've got low investment. We've got low GDP growth, and we've got very high unemployment. So I think that baselines things. And then I think operationally, there's two things that you have to think about. I mean, I think, first of all, a lot of what we see is crisis management. There's a lot of crises that we have to deal with, electricity crisis, logistics crisis, water crisis, and so on. And I think we need to move to a more proactive approach, and I think that's partly what these papers are about. And then I think lastly, you have to think about the context in which recovery has to take place. And I think there you have to worry about legislation. You can't launch recovery into a situation that has unfriendly economic policies. And I think the example of that is there's seven major pieces of legislation that was launched over the last 2 years. And there's just under 50 legal challenges for that in either the Supreme Court or the Constitutional Court. So if you read through the documentation, there's three major complaints. The first is that there was not adequate public participation. The second complaint is the submissions that's been made by business wasn't taken seriously. And the last is we didn't really take into account the economy. So I think things are very difficult at the present moment, and that sets the scene for solutions. I think that's where I'll leave it.
Especially, Fatima, where we hear that capital markets are the engines of growth. They're the barometer of economies worldwide, right? So I want to take a look at reality versus potential right at the top. How far or how wide is the gap between the reality, given the context that Francois just outlined, versus the potential that these markets have to play a more transformative role than they're playing right now?
Yeah, I think what was really fantastic that came out consistently across all the papers was that South Africa, you know, we've got two extreme nodes. We've got high levels of inequality. Yeah. We've got a very sophisticated financial sector, yet we have these incredibly high levels of unemployment. So what I found very rewarding out of all the papers that I read was the most innovative ideas always stem from when you have the most difficult challenges. And what each author was trying to do was trying to find those solutions to those incredibly difficult challenges. And if you ask me about the gap exists. Our capital markets are distant from how to actually deploy capital to create jobs. And I think the winning ideas that came out of the various papers, implementation is always going to be a challenge, and you've got to think about implementation, but they definitely brought together a wonderful set of ideas. If we have an environment that is conducive to listen to those ideas, I'm just hoping that we do not lose these bright South Africans and they do not leave South Africa.
Before I move on to Leila, what would you say are the top three barriers that are preventing the capital markets from playing and fulfilling the role that they could be playing?
Well, it's the environment. And as Francois said, you know, it's just nothing gets taken seriously. And everything, I work very closely with some government entities, etc., and just the ability to make coherent decisions, that we're not short of money and we're not short of ideas, but we're short of implementers. And for some reason, there's this massive blockage to get things implemented.
So Leila, let's bring your voice into the conversation at this point. What needs to change structurally or from a policy point of view or a confidence point of view for our markets to effectively mobilize capital into the real economy and turn that savings base into a real engine for growth?
The exchange is actually in quite an odd position in terms of addressing what you're suggesting. We are 250%, our market cap is 250% of GDP, and we're the 19th largest in the world, whereas we are the 38th largest by GDP. And so you can see there's a very big separation between capital formation and trading and wealth creation and the reality on the ground. More than 40% of our listed entities in terms of market cap derive their income outside of South Africa. Yes. That said, I think we have a great opportunity because of the difficulties that Francois has discussed. And I think what is needed, and many of these ideas were identified in the papers, is firstly policy shifts to enable a tax efficient environment, whether it's for small and medium enterprises, for investors, or for the enterprises. We also need to enable much higher levels of education, financial literacy. We run a program which reaches 60,000 children, students or learners a year, and it's a gamified approach to trading. And that's very successful, but it's a drop in the ocean of really what's needed. Countries like India, countries like Thailand are getting it right. They have full participation of the retail sector. Finally, we need risk appetite to open up. Right now, our markets are very institutionally based. We have very few speculative investment opportunity or a willingness to invest into the small and medium enterprise environment. When you look at the delistings that we've had on the JSE, those are almost exclusively in the small and mid-cap space. Mm. And the reason for that is that they don't get price formation. They're not able to achieve the share price that they should achieve relative to their net asset value because there isn't an appetite by the investor to invest in the small end of town. Yeah. So you need the have a go, speculative, really open-minded investors to start growing the small end of town because that's where the job creation sits.
Absolutely. And where the capital is flowing, you've got those domestic savings either remaining idle or being channeled offshore as opposed to being filtered through to the productive investment in South Africa in particular. Malu, we had Leila highlight that there are some out there that are getting it right. So who's getting it right, where they've got, you know, deep, credible markets that have managed to reshape their economies? And what kind of lessons can South Africa be extracting from those examples that are optimizing capital allocation, building trust that actually justifies capital flow?
Yeah, there are lots of examples out there. So if I may just underscore, you know, some of the points that Leila has made. You know, if you look at our scenario in South Africa, you find that we've got a very deep, you know, markets, if you like, but we lack breadth. You know, we're not kind of, our assets are not going through to different places where it's needed, whether it be rural areas or it be informal market or it be townships. So I think that for me, if you look at the structure of our economy in South Africa, South Africa is made out of large companies, large corporates, and whether it's banks, we're talking about five big banks now with Capitec, you know, we're talking about big insurers, we talk about big construction companies, you know, and us big asset managers, and the list goes on. So, you know, it leaves very little, you know, for the small guy that wants to grow to actually scale up in this environment. So, and I think that structure of the economy is the one that's making, you know, it difficult for the micro, small and medium enterprises to flourish in the environment. So in areas where you've got places where the small micro enterprise flourishing, places like Kenya, I think Kenyans are getting it right. Things like M-Pesa, which is always spoken about, where they've taken, you know, they've actually leapfrogged banking, you know, by using your cell phone to transact. And even now, you know, there's actually a new listing that's coming to the JSE, which is a micro lender that's using AI, you know. And I think, you know, we need to really think very creatively and innovatively in terms of the traditional ways of assessing credit worthiness, you know. And this is what these guys are doing, you know. And I think some of the examples that I'll talk about here, you know, where you can actually change that old traditional way of, say, you have to have a collateral, you know, to get a loan as a micro company. What other means, what other ways can you assess the credit worthiness? Yeah. You know, as I said, you know, you've got many other examples of some of those countries that really allow, you know, the micro
to be bold
enterprises. Absolutely. Yeah. We need to be a bit bolder.
Yeah.
You've got to be bold, you've got to be brave, especially Chris, in an environment where, you know, a big part of this entire equation is policy credibility and macro stability at the end of the day. We've already got, we've gotten a sense of the sound ecosystem that's in play, from a credible central bank to treasury and then the exchange itself. So where capability is, certainly there, what policy shifts, you know, do we need to start seeing and seeing fast in order to strengthen investor sentiment and deepen the capital markets locally?
What I took away from these papers, what I really liked about them, is that they tackled specific aspects of our broader environment that don't work, right? Mm-hmm. So some of the papers focused very specifically on solving information asymmetries that would speak to these issues around how do you get money to small businesses and what are the particular problems that small businesses face. So there was a lot in the papers that I thought was very innovative that can be taken out and used directly into a policy environment. Some of it had to do with technology. A lot of it had to do with sort of innovative ways of figuring out where a company is coming from, where their revenue is coming from, and how do you verify that their revenue is the revenue they say it is, and then how do you kind of use that in a capital markets environment to ensure that funding goes to them. So that was one aspect that I thought was really great. Another one, a bigger picture one, was about public investment, right? And I mean, I've felt for many years that the problem is, you know, you've got a huge amount of demand for network services and public infrastructure and public investment, but the supply is failing, and we all know this. And so again, where some of that real innovation lay was in identifying countries around the world where particular parts of that pipeline are identified to have worked, whether it was in Kenya or it was in Colombia or if it was in the UK or wherever. And they were identified and pulled in and sort of said, well, okay, well, how would we use this particular part of that bigger pipeline to solve South Africa's problems? And I thought that was really great. I mean, there's really a menu out there that policymakers can take and develop. You've got to be willing to take some risks, and you've got to be willing to invest in the systems that you need to make these things work right. You know, just like PPPs, you know, how do you get PPPs to work? We've had PPPs for many years. But why don't they attract the investment that they need? Yeah. There are examples out there where it does work much better.
You've drawn quite a few elements from the paper that essentially laid out or gave you a playbook for productive capital in South Africa, right? Arguing that South Africa doesn't lack capital, it lacks productive capital, and we've got to channel that in the right direction. Francois, that thinking was echoed in the paper Move, Multiply, Matter as well, which highlighted specifically that we're sitting on, 21 trillion rand in financial assets, and that it needs a more agile and connected capital market in order to be put to work. You know, we don't have time to go through all of the aspects and the nitty-gritty of the paper this evening, but I noticed specifically a focus on execution. So execution intermediaries that come into play and take concept to bankability. And I think that putting a very loud emphasis on the fact that we need bankable projects even in this very challenging environment that you've outlined.
I mean, I think that was an excellent paper. The first part was just to optimally use capital. So there was a lot of examples there whereby aggregating finance, you could effectively lower the cost of capital. It's a huge charge for municipalities, for the government in general. And I think the paper tackled that quite effectively. The other part, which I think where you're getting at, is there was a lot of time spent on SMEs, discussing SMEs, and how can you not start them, but how can you accelerate them? So they were talking, this particular author was talking about laddering, and how do you scale and super scale SMEs, which I thought was excellent. I thought we haven't got the time to discuss all the ideas. And then I think the last part about that paper, which I really liked, the third aspect, was inclusion. But you couldn't drive inclusion at some of the things that Mala was talking about, townships, stockfells, and so on. It was how do you include them in the modern economy? And I think the innovative idea that this particular author had was to create platforms, inclusive platforms, and where they then participate and where it's clear and transparent with rules and so on, better regulated. So I mean, I think that was an excellent paper, and I think as I think all the judges have said, I don't think there was a shortage of good ideas.
Yeah, and it put the focus on depth, creating or deepening capital markets, Fatima. But there's also a focus on moving that depth to reach. Right, there was a paper, How Capital Markets Can Unlock Youth Potential and Drive Inclusive Growth, and it tackled youth inclusion head on, so a broadening of access to these markets. So what did it put on the table when it came to redesigning access so that you have the youth more involved?
Absolutely. And a lot of what I really enjoyed about that paper was the author spoke about the youth are always being regarded as job seekers in the South African environment. However, there's a lot of innovation taking place in the townships and elsewhere where youth are finding innovative ways and creative ways of, creating new products, creating new services, etc. But how do they then gain access? How do people find out about them? How do they get into the capital markets? And again, it's this extreme world where the JSE considers as this high-level, sophisticated market, and then you have everything else. And what we're also seeing increasingly is the traditional intermediaries are getting disintermediated. So if we think about the traditional big banks, and Malu raised this earlier, is that they're getting disintermediated because we're seeing the emergence of these innovative ideas and creative ways of bringing capital to the people, bringing capital to the township economy and the vibrancy. And, you know, we recently had, I think the CEO of Capitec said, spoke about the unemployment and the jobs numbers on how they're getting reported, et cetera, because of the number of people that are being employed in the township economy. Are those being taken into consideration? So I loved the ideas about the youth in the townships, the youth elsewhere in South Africa. How do they gain access to capital and what are those mechanisms? And we got to stop thinking about the JSE as this elitist institution that is only there for big capital.
Yeah.
And we, you know, Leila is here and we can talk about it, but consistently across all the papers that reference the JSE, they spoke about the bureaucratic processes, they spoke about the expensiveness of being listed as a JSE company, companies are delisting because of the costs of being a listed company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we really need to tackle some of those blockages head on.
Leila, what did you make of the ideas that were put out there when it comes to redesigning access so that the capital market genuinely includes young entrepreneurs and investors as participants and not just spectators?
I think a lot is already happening and a lot more still needs to be done. For any market to work, you need both investors and you need companies that are bankable and are looking to raise capital. Now, the problem that we have is that many of the companies that are looking to raise capital, and those are the employers of the future, and that's where the employment rate is really growing. Those companies are not appealing enough, and it's actually not as much about red tape as it is about those companies not being able to attract the right capital at the right share price. And what we have done in the past couple of years is cut red tape. We've reduced the amount of work that particularly small companies have to raise. We've segmented boards into a prime and a general segment, the general segment being the low end of town, where they have much fewer requirements. I think on the investor side, we have a real dislocation in this country because we don't have enough youth, we don't have enough retail man in the street investors. And I would put that down to three problems. Price, it is expensive for those for anyone to trade on the exchange. Access, people don't understand how to access a broker, what to do. We haven't digitized access in the same way that many other countries have. And it's a whole of community thing. And I think financial literacy is the final area. And a lot is being done. But we really do need to do more to crowd in financing from the man in the street.
Absolutely.
Rather than having them, those people who have a speculative mindset in a gambling environment, let them actually put their money to work in a savings environment.
Yeah. Milo, there was a very bold submission, and you alluded to it in your earlier answer, right? VAT verified revenue notes, rewiring capital markets to finance SMEs and create jobs. I mean, this proposal essentially uses VAT data as collateral, unlocking SME credit through structured, transparent instruments. Given your experience in structuring products, yeah, how feasible is this really in practice? And what would it take for investors to trust, buy in, and scale a product like this?
No, that was absolutely one of the best. And actually, I discussed it with Francois. And really, I think for me, what I was looking at very good ideas that are implementable. Mm-hmm. And in other words, you know, good examples or rather good ideas that don't need any policy change. Because I tell you what, I mean, our policy environment is archaic, as Francois said. You know, some of the policies that we implemented, legislation that has come through recently, have really not been practical, and they've also not considered economic impact into what it does to the economy or existing industries and stuff like that. So for me, you know, if you are to leave it to government to legislate and create a policy, it's never going to be implemented. So I think that's where kind of my issue was. And especially if you look at this VAT verified, you know, revenues, quite a novel idea, you know, in terms of looking at, you know, other means to actually, or criteria to look at, you know, lending, you know, these small medium enterprises. And I liked it, you know, it didn't want collaterals, but all they said, guys, if we can verify your revenue, you know, based on your submissions to SARS, you know, which, you know, it's, you know, it's undisputable, then you're able to raise funds. Mm. But my issue was, if you look at where the hiccups are going to be, it's really in terms of the regulatory environment. What are you going to do with POPIA, which is, you know, that information? What are you going to do about the Tax Application Act? Because you really have to have National Treasury, you know, promulgating some kind of amendment to the Tax Act, and you need to have SARS to implement that, you know, in terms of, you know, allowing this to happen. Mm. I think that's really where the rubber hits the road in terms of implementation, you know, and I think, but what a great idea, but implementation is going to rely on many other parties, you know, let alone government, that really, you know, I don't believe that they've got the capacity, and also they're not going to move with speed if they've got other priorities.
And I guess that is a problem that props up as well, Chris, for something like a proposal that put GridShare SA. I'm not going to pretend to say that I have wrapped my head around this concept in its entirety, but a national platform using AI-powered microgrids and peer-to-peer energy trading to deliver reliable, affordable electricity, create jobs, and give investors a new way to profit from funding green energy at a local level. And where you've got this, you know, this policy and regulatory constraint that pops up, as Malu says, you know, I would think that the current regulatory and infrastructure development situation in South Africa poses a bit of a challenge for this proposal too.
Well, you need both sides of the equation to work, right? So you've got to have ideas that can scale up and people would want to be invested in it, right? So part of what everyone has said, is that uncertainty plays a role in your investment horizon. So you're going to stay away from novel investment instruments if you are in an environment that's more uncertain. So you need a kind of a macroeconomic level of certainty or greater certainty, and then you need a regulatory environment that allows that as well. And that particular paper, I thought, again, very interesting, but you clearly need to have an energy regulatory system that allows for those kinds of innovation projects to be put on the table and fast-tracked. If you have to wait 5 or 10 years for the approval of a license for those kinds of grids, then of course they're not going to be attractive to anybody. I mean, they're not going to be attractive to the local community, and they're not going to be attractive to investors.
Yeah. You know, what was exciting about the policy ideas that emerged tops this year, Francois, is that they were so interconnected. You know, each of the proposal, kind of the proposals tackling a different piece of the economic puzzle that needs to be put together, but also illustrative of the ideas that are out there that if they don't sit in their silos can actually come into being and take real effect. And that's more just getting your comment, not the direct question.
Yeah. I mean, just to get to Shanae's paper, I think Fatima actually sponsored that, because I think at least my approach was to look at the technical quality of all the papers, were they properly sourced, did it hang together, what level of complexity, and so on. But Fatima basically said, we should take another look at this particular paper. And I think what came out of it was not just the fact that she addressed the big question in South Africa, which was this huge unemployment, particularly in the youth. But there's kind of three things that jumped out of that paper for me. So the first was she didn't really say that the youth needed any favors. She said it needs to be aspirational. We want to look up to somebody. We want somebody to set an example for us. The second thing that came out of it for me was she spoke, it was about incentives. It was, tell me what I need to do to be successful. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a quite a nice thing. And then the other part that jumped out, of course, this didn't come through on the first reading. Fatima kind of told us to look for this stuff, but was that she wanted a fair shake. She wanted confidence to be able to say that she would be protected with this particular endeavor. So on the second reading of that particular paper, I mean, I think the thing that jumped out at me is I was thinking about my grandfather, who was a farmer. He asked for three things. He said, give me rain, give me a bit of luck, and I'll do the rest. You know, so that's what I liked about that paper. She didn't really ask for favors. And I think that was what came out of all of the papers for me. It was people who, despite the difficulties that I painted at the outset, was proactive and was prepared to be solution minded, but also cognizant that that had to happen in an environment where they had a reasonable probability of success. I think my fellow judges can maybe give their views on that.
Yeah. Leila, it speaks to helping or facilitating a building of success when these proposals are put on the table. And that was something that was highlighted as well with something like the Education District Bonds paper, because it highlighted how it can unlock inclusive growth and jobs. It reframed education funding as an investable asset, using district-level bonds to channel private capital into both education and skills. How can exchanges like the JSE help build credibility and appetite for these kinds of social impact instruments, you know, where growth and justice are intertwined?
Yeah, and I think that paper touched on a lot of what we already have in place and was just really building from that. So if you think about our sustainable suite of bonds, which were introduced in 2017, that's debt financing, which is used for social bonds, for green, which is climate related, and for sustainability. And I think those are areas where you're getting funding for, in this instance, it was education, but here you're getting funding for schools, you're getting funding for medical hospitals, and those bonds have grown by more than 50% every year. And we've got nearly 80 bonds that have been listed now. So I think this was very much in line with what is already in place. I think where this really takes it a step further is impact bonds, which is measuring the output rather than and funding that's based on not that we have spent 500 million rand on a school, but that we've educated and graduated 500 students. So you measure things from the output or the impact rather than the input or where the funds are going to be funneled. In addition to that, we have launched a private market. And there are it's debt and equity financing, and it's a wonderful idea. And we've got 55 companies who are seeking to raise capital, which could be in the form of funding. But many of those requests have not been funded. We've got dry powder on the one side, and we've got companies looking to raise capital in the same way that these education bonds are being proposed. And so I think I come back to, you have to have both sides of the coin, and it's really important to make sure that those offers are bankable, that they are creditworthy, and that they are accessible and easy to trade. There's also quite a lot of work required to try and crowd in, if you do a crowdfunding style engagement. So you need you need enough information about the creditworthiness. You need enough protections in place to protect investors. And at the same time, you need to educate and make sure that it's simple enough so that people can understand. Many people in the street don't understand what a coupon is. They don't understand what a bond, how it actually works. Kenya have done an awesome job in gamifying their government bonds, and they've incorporated it into M-Pesa, and you can take your coupons, and it's reframed in your app, and you can use those to pay for your groceries or, you know, pay for your child's education. And I think that's what we need to do. Both the exchange together with our participants is simplify things and gamify and make them more accessible so that we can use a crowdfunding approach.
Yeah. Fatima, what role should institutional investors be playing in addressing inequality and promoting inclusive growth through capital allocation?
So I think one of the things that Leila did raise was that the JSE is very heavily dependent on institutional investors. So if we look at South Africa, we've got a 4.5 trillion rand pensions market outside of the Government Employees Pension Fund. We've got a 4 trillion rands collective investment schemes industry. And those are the industries that basically trade on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. What I really loved out of some of the papers that came through, because you need the private sector, you need the public sector, you need DFIs, you need the retail market, you need the township economy, you need all of it to work together. And that's really where you come to the idea of blended finance and how we can efficiently use blended finance to de-risk investments as well as bring in new forms of capital for funding the type of projects that we need to have in South Africa so that we can create the economic growth and we can have the jobs and, you know, the cycle, then the virtuous cycle begins to turn. So from a capital markets perspective, I think, you know, a lot of ideas have come through the papers. A lot of the judges have spoken to some of those ideas. But really, if we can get multiple diverse sets of investors being able to support the capital markets, as opposed to now, you know, it's not frictionless, and we need to find a frictionless way of bringing all of them together to be able to boost liquidity. I mean, you know, Leila talks about the private market segment that has been set up. We talk about the social bonds segment, the sustainability-linked bonds segment, but there's no liquidity in any of those segments. Liquidity doesn't exist, so you can't. The innovation is there; it's been created. It's, you know, the platforms are there, but nobody is trading on those platforms. One, because of the diversity of the investor. So, from a pension fund's perspective and institutional investors' perspective, the rules are there, and they have the ability to invest in a diverse suite of investments as institutional investors. And it's really about the education. Are the right people saying the right things? Are we creating awareness that these things exist? Are we diversifying our portfolios? Because the JSE's become too small for the large amount of capital that are chasing a few stocks. You know, like if we just see what's happened recently, it's like 5 resource counters that drove the performance. Everything else was flat. And that's why a lot of the capital is going offshore. Yeah. You know, 45% of an average pensioner's portfolio is sitting offshore. So institutional investors are desperately looking for the mechanisms to support economic growth and job creation, etc. And That's why some of the solutions that were put forward around infrastructure investment, how to de-risk projects, how to crowd in other investors like DFIs, like the private sector, through blended finance mechanisms, and then making those, pushing those through the capital markets, I think will work.
Yeah. Chris, how can the Saab Treasury and you know, private sector work more cohesively to boost long-term investment growth? And perhaps, you know, where are you seeing instances or opportunities for capital markets to work alongside or complement some of the economic strategies that are in play?
Well, so I think capital markets ought to be chasing best practice around the world, wherever that is. And part of best practice came out in these papers, again, in the idea of, well, how can public policy deal with market failures? And how do those market failures impact on the investability of things? How do you scale up? Where does risk lie? And so, you know, I think, from a public policy perspective, broadening out the array of tools that governments have to address those kinds of market failures is absolutely critical. Again, you know, the papers pointed to some really nice places and learnings and projects where these things work. You know, again, best practice includes government being on top of that and understanding the role of policy in addressing those market failures. There's no question that those market failures exist, and they need to be plugged. I don't think you can expect the private sector to do that by itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Francois, so if we get to the competition details now, I mean, you raised the stakes this year, not only increasing the prize money, but also broadening, you know, the scope and the categories that were recognized, making a special mention this evening. To what extent did this broader incentive achieve what you set out to do, and what inspired you to widen the net in the first place?
I think part of the logic of picking the topic on markets is because we've got these deep liquid markets in South Africa, and at the same time you've got unemployment, and that's kind of counterintuitive, because everywhere else in the world where you have deep capital markets, usually you have tremendous innovation because you need to fund these projects. Usually what that results in is improved productivity. And usually what that results in is higher real wages, you know, and increased employment. So you've kind of got the situation in South Africa where you ought to have success, but we don't have it. And I think Malo highlighted some of the reasons for that. So I think the reason for highlighting capital markets is sometimes they get knocked. Sometimes people say, gee, you know, it's unfair or this or that, but it's vital to the success of South Africa, and it's a necessary condition for future success, but on its own, it's not gonna fix things. Yeah. So we need to tackle some of these other topics. I think our primary concern is also that we worry that that you don't actually get implementation, some of the points that Malo was talking about. And we want to get a path where people, you know, a kind of roadmap with signposts on things that you need to do. And what was fascinating out of all of the papers is, if you combine them, there's a very clear roadmap for success in South Africa, and we should be celebrating. You know, I started on a negative note, but to end on a positive note, you know, you've got fine institutions like National Treasury and the Saab. You've got a law system through the Constitutional Court, which operates optimally. You've got the capital markets. So you should actually try and figure out how, in spite of those things, we're not achieving success.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what came out of this competition. There is actually no reason why we shouldn't have success.
Yep.
And that's why we will continue to, you know, to participate with ASA in these kinds of competitions, yeah. because I think it tackles that the heart of the issue.
Yeah, Malu, 6 out of over 200 entries being recognized this evening. What were the toughest calls when it came to that whittling down process, and how did you and the rest of your panelists finally decide on a winner?
Yeah, so it was quite an interesting process, and lots of reading, I must say, and rereading. And so I was marking mine, and obviously there was a criteria to mark, each paper, and obviously allocate marks. And then, but then after reading, as I read, I give these guys a high mark, and then we go down, and then you have to kind of review again and say, no, this looks more interesting. And then how you bring that up. And then that was really like an interesting process. But I think for me, what was really driving the scoring is the implementation, to be able to implement, to be able to see the impact of how, this could be implemented at the shortest period of time and see the results. I think, one of the questions I always ask myself is that what can the citizens or the population or private sector do without needing government?
Yeah.
So if we can get to that point where there's things that we can do, to grow the economy, to create jobs without needing any government intervention, I think for me that would be the holy grail. So yeah.
And Leila, something that Malu highlighted there is one of the criteria, right? Balance bold thinking with implementable, sustainable, and measurable impact. So if we talk impact, and this one, as we start to wrap this conversation up to you now, with you having been part of the team that submitted B20 proposals to the G20, winner selected, what now? What's the next step? What's the pathway from idea to implementation in a country where good ideas can often get trapped in political gridlock? So how do we make sure that these ideas reach the right decision makers?
Well, I think we do need people with convening power and the ability to interact with all the players that are relevant. I thought there were some excellent papers. In fact, I'd love to chat to Mpo after this, if you hear, because some of those ideas I thought were really very powerful. We interact with the Saab, the Fisker, the National Treasury on many environments. We run a project called Project Pumalela, where we're looking to open up the market and open up competitiveness. And I think a lot of these ideas could be very powerfully used to generate action. And I think if we have some private sector people working in a college with the regulators, discussing and distilling some of those very powerful ideas, I think we can next year perhaps celebrate something much more than just winning, not that it's a trivial thing, but than winning a prize. We can celebrate real success in changing markets and putting these exceptional ideas that all of the contributors have brought forward into action.
All of that said, I think very little argument that as South Africa looks to reignite growth, the role of our capital markets in mobilizing investment, supporting entrepreneurship, and driving transformation has become ever critical. These markets aren't just about numbers. They aren't just about trading screens. They're about how we connect savings to opportunity and how we transform investment into jobs, into growth, and long-term prosperity. On that note, that's where we leave it for this episode of the Think Big series. From me, Alicia Seckham, it's goodbye. Until next time.